You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, June 18th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor Eric Loomis, author of Out of Sight, the long disturbing story of corporations outsourcing catastrophe. Also on the program today, 9 dead in a shooting in the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in downtown Charleston, South Carolina. A 21-year-old white racist extremist, right-wing extremist, terrorist, really, has been apprehended in this shooting, supposedly reloaded multiple times, told the people in the church, "You're raping our women, you all have to go," and then opened fire. Also on the program today, NASA says we are running out of water on this planet, anyways. Also, DDT, long banned in this country, still being used in other countries, now found to have a link to breast cancer in the children or the children of women exposed to it when they were young. Reportedly, Obama has brokered a secret deal that could cut down on the fighting in Libya. Walmart discovered to have a huge network of tax dodges. And SCOTUS comes out with a couple of cases, one in which the Sons of Confederates lose their opportunity to put the Confederate flag on their license plates. And speaking of Confederate flags, the governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley, has ordered that all flags in South Carolina be flown at half-mast, including the Confederate flag, which still flies over the Capitol in South Carolina. What is the relevance of that? Well, let me quote from an interview with John Mullins, who went to high school with Dylan Storm Roof, the 21-year-old white man who killed 9 with his .45 caliber pistol, which he received as a birthday present from his dad. He has a vanity license plate with the Confederate flag on it. And his buddy from high school said, "I never heard him say anything. He just had that kind of Southern pride, I guess. Strong conservative beliefs. He made a lot of racist jokes, but you don't really take them seriously like that. You don't really think of it like that." But now the things he said were kind of not joking, Mullins added. Yeah, you probably take it a little more seriously if you're black. I mean, we're going to talk more about this story, obviously, as the show progresses. But I can tell you that what we're seeing now from the right wing is that they are claiming this is an attack on Christianity. And obviously, this is absurd. This is, the idea that we would hear people on Fox News talk about ISIS attacks as attacks on Islam. Because you know that is the vast majority of people who ISIS are killing, right, is other Muslims. And the idea that Dylan Storm Roof went into that black church because it was a church and not a black church is just absurd. He has been apprehended about 250 miles from Charleston in Shelby, South Carolina. Shelby, South Carolina, you'll recall, was the county which was in question in the Supreme Court ruling from 2 years ago, where the Supreme Court of the United States said that racism was effectively over and we didn't need a Voting Rights Act. I guess actually that was Shelby County, Alabama, but nevertheless, maybe just a touch of irony. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Eric Loomis, author of Out of Sight, The Long, Disturbing Story of Corporations Outsourcing Catastrophe. We'll be right back. Folks, this is the last opportunity, the last day that you can get the great deal from Credo Mobile that Credo Mobile is offering. Majority Report listeners, go to credomobile.com/majority report or call 800-966-1665. Use the code 501-882. They're giving you a great deal to be a part of America's only progressive wireless phone company. Get $100 off any phone, plus 25% off your data plan fees for 1 year. On top of that, Credo will give you a credit on your bill to cover the cost of switching over any type of early termination fee, up to $350 per line. They'll also give you a trade-in credit of $300 for your current phone, up to that anyways. So check it out. CredoMobile.com/majority report. This is your last chance. Check it out, folks. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of History at the University of Rhode Island, blogger at Lawyers, Guns, and Money, and author of his latest, Out of Sight, The Long and Disturbing Story of Corporations Outsourcing Catastrophe, Eric Loomis. Welcome to the program, Eric. Oh, sorry. Welcome to the program, Eric.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So the thing I really enjoy about your book is that it is almost a direct answer to we get quite a few calls from libertarians on this program, and it is almost a direct answer to the entire notion of economic libertarianism in many respects. And before we get specifically to that part, but let's start with the shirtwaist triangle factory fire. We've spoken about that on this program many times, but remind people what it was, because in some ways the model that existed at that time seems to continue to be the paradigm, at least for that industry, though not necessarily in this country.
Right. I mean, I think the apparel industry, clothing industry, has always been based on exploitation, and that's why in my book I start with the Triangle Fire and I end with the Rana Plaza collapse in Bangladesh. It's the same industry. So, you know, basically, in 1911, 146 workers, mostly young female immigrants, working in a sweatshop in New York City, die when their building catches on fire. And this happened in front of many important middle class, upper class people. The sweatshop was on New York City's Lower East Side. It was a nice day. So people were out strolling, and people saw these young women die. And this outrage convinced Americans to start stepping in and regulating the conditions of clothing production, because these women had been fighting, these young women had been fighting for workplace safety and better conditions and an end to this exploitative sweatshop labor, subcontracted labor, the same system we see today. They've been fighting for an end of it. In 1909, they go on a strike called the Uprising of the 20,000, which was demanding workplace safety, among other things. And so, you know, they die in 1911, and what happens is that Americans begin to, again, step in and start regulating these things. And so in New York, for instance, you have better building safety, fire safety, workplace safety that comes out of people witnessing this fire. And that begins a process where during the 20th century, Americans began to demand of their government and fight in order to make the government have better workplace conditions as well as better environmental conditions. So everything from 8-hour day to the minimum wage to overtime pay to pollution controls, et cetera, all of this is intended to make America a good place to live and create the American middle class. The apparel industry wants to escape this. And so what they begin to do is first move to the South, and that's even as early as the 1920s. And then by the 1960s and 70s, they start moving to Mexico, and then they start moving to Asia. And, you know, today, if you look at what happened in 2013, where over 1,100 workers die in the exact same industry as the Triangle Fire, you see very, very similar conditions, subcontracted labor, terrible workplace safety, sexual harassment of women, all sorts of terrible things. It's the same industry doing the same thing, except that today we don't see it because it's thousands of miles away. So consumers are not going to become activists to stop this from happening again.
You know, I remember when this disaster at the Rana Plaza took place, and I remember you had a sort of a back and forth with, I think it was Matthew Iglesias. I don't know if he was at Vox at the time. I can't really remember. And there was the debate, if I remember correctly, was what can we do, not just as consumers in terms of, like, I'm not going to buy clothes from Bangladesh, but what can we do as citizens in terms of exercising some control over us? I mean, explain to us that sort of debate, because I think Iglesias was saying, like, it's perfectly acceptable or it makes total sense for the Bangladeshis to have less safe conditions for their workers so that their economy can flourish, I guess. I may not be doing his argument justice, but walk us through that.
That's essentially what he was arguing, that, you know, basically it's okay for Bangladeshis to have less of workplace safety because, you know, so their economy can grow. And, you know, and use the language of choice that, you know, Bangladesh chooses this. But, you know, I mean, that might exist in economic theory, but the real choice that these workers in Bangladesh had that day was either go into the factory where they could already see cracks in the wall, and they were scared to death of going into that factory. But the employers said, you either go into the factory or you get docked a month's pay. Well, you know, who can afford to be docked a month's pay? And so they all, so, you know, 1,100 of them died. That's the real choice that they're making. And you know, the way so many people talk about these things is that workers in these countries, Bangladesh, China, Cambodia, Honduras, Guatemala, Western corporations are basically gifting them jobs, they're so poor, and then Western companies come and they give them the gifts of these unsafe jobs, and then they are going to, you know, somehow miraculously rise in the world thanks to these, you know, sweatshop jobs. That's not true. It doesn't have to be that way. I mean, the issues of why, you know, these jobs are why people take these jobs in places like Bangladesh is really complicated. It gets around issues of a lot of farmers being kicked off their land, for instance. There's a whole lot of issues around this. But I think to be succinct, you can have jobs that there may be reasons to produce clothing in Bangladesh. I mean, the clothing industry is not going to come back to the United States, not in any large way. And so I think that we have to make the decision to say, look, it's maybe that industry is not coming back to America, but we have a moral obligation to make sure that people don't die on the job. There may be cheaper labor there, but there's no good reason that these companies should be able to exploit these workers to the extent that the buildings fall down around them. There's no reason that the companies should be able to exploit these communities to the extent that the rivers run pink or green or blue or purple, depending on what the clothing companies are using that day, what dyes they're using that day. There's no reason this has to happen. Americans have for a long time made decisions about the standards that they're going to allow for goods being imported into our country. I mean, we don't allow owl dyes, for instance. You know, we have an endangered, you know, there's a convention on endangered species. You know, we don't allow those kind of goods into our country. And so right. We can make these sorts of choices. And I think that's the actual choice. It's not about Bangladeshi workers choosing to work on safe jobs. It's about us making a choice about how the goods that we wear and we consume are going to be produced.
It's fascinating to me that there's this concept out there that those who sort of subscribe to that, I guess, notion of economic theory, that somehow there's a fundamental difference between someone holding a gun to your head and saying, go in there and work in that factory that's unsafe, or someone not holding a gun to your head, but basically saying, like, the alternate is you can't feed your family. And so one, I pull the trigger, you die right away. The other is you just go through an extended period of suffering before your family and your kids maybe die of hunger. I mean, that's really the it seems to me the where the sort of rhetorical trick happens, right? That the notion of coercion is only at the butt of a gun, as opposed to the sort of the denial of work.
Yeah, and it's very scary to me because this equation that you just laid out was the fundamental equation of the horrible late 19th century that led to things like the Triangle Fire, that basically the economic ideas of employment coming out of that time was that, you know, that I, John D. Rockefeller, and you know, Watt, being an immigrant, we both have choices that we're making about whether you want to work for me or not. And if you don't want to work for in these conditions, you don't have to. It's your choice. But of course, that Watian immigrant didn't have any choice because the Watian immigrant had to feed his family. And I think that, and the flip side of that then, at that time, was that unions, therefore, were an unfair conglomerate seeking to undermine free trade or undermine these free choices. So to see that ideology come back today, I think is very scary, because what it's doing is recreating the intellectual framework of the terrible employment conditions of 100 years ago or 125 years ago, but now they're on a globalized scale that is both subjecting the working classes of the world to these very unnecessary conditions, as well as undermining both unions and the middle class in this country. And so I think these are ideas that have to be pushed back on very hard.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's two different dynamics happening. There's that dynamic that you just explained, this dynamic of the sort of the resurgence of this notion of the free market. I mean, it's almost like it almost coincides, it seems to me, with as people who lived through the Great Depression pass away, and as we get further in history, in time, away from that era, and there's just sort of this absence of awareness of what it was like, right? I mean, it doesn't, as if none of these things, that the natural state has always been where it is today. And we are, in fact, inhibiting what the natural state is by somehow, calling for more regulation. That's one dynamic. And then the other dynamic is obviously the fact that when we see those conditions that existed Great Depression or pre-1920s, the Gilded Age, when those conditions exist, they're actually physically too far away from us rather than temporally in Bangladesh.
Yes. I mean, I think that both of those issues are really important in this, that loss of lived memory of true poverty, particularly among the majority of white people. I mean, because I think that, African-American, Latino communities, Native American communities certainly have a much more lived experience of poverty in this country. But I think that the New Deal and the post-war period, which really raised white incomes tremendously, I think that losing that memory of poverty has led a lot of people to sort of really buy into ideas of that capitalism can do, or that corporations can do more for us than government. The government gets in the way, and I think a lot of that is also connected to the fact that you really see beginnings of shifts in these issues when the government begins to get involved in as early as the 1960s to promote not just the welfare of white people, but also the welfare of Black Americans and other minorities. And so it's a racialized sense as well. So what that's led to is the disappearance of a lot of factory workers in the United States, disappearance of industrial jobs, and of course the big industrial unions like the auto workers and steel workers and rubber workers, et cetera, and that work all being shipped overseas. And I think that distance really, really helps corporations because then it's very intentional, because what they want to do is make sure that we as consumers don't see the impact of production. Because if we see the impact of production, most of us are, fairly sympathetic human beings, and we have compassion for others, and we don't actually want people to die. But if we don't die making our clothes or food or whatever, but if we don't see it, we're not going to pay attention to it. It needs to be thrown in our faces to a certain extent. And so by putting this stuff in Bangladesh, in Cambodia, in Honduras, we can't even find these places on maps. So the only people really outraged by what happened in Bangladesh are, people like me, other people who really already had an interest in, working conditions and worldwide labor and these sorts of things. But the everyday consumer, the clothing just appears on the shelf, right, or on the hanger at the Gap. You don't have to think about where it comes from. It's just there. And I think that distance between production and consumption is very, very powerful for corporations, and that's why they work so hard to make sure that we don't know how their goods are produced.
Do you think in the boardrooms, when they start talking about where we're going to subcontract, and then where their contractor, I should say, is going to subcontract, do you think there is a consciousness of maybe wages are at some type of parity in terms of Mexico, and maybe shipping costs would be slightly cheaper if they were in this hemisphere, but we put this stuff in Bangladesh, or we put this stuff in Malaysia, We're never going to have to worry about, you know, some blogger doing a or some, you know, ABC News reporter doing a story on this with video that's going to be followed up on.
Well, it's a piece of their decision-making. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, part of the reason that they can go to a place like Bangladesh is that the wages are lower than in Mexico. And I think that, you know, that the that's probably still the fundamental reason, but it is very you know, important to them that that, you know, ABC News reporter not show up on the front door, that it does, that it does seem and in fact physically is far away. And we do know, you know, for instance, you know, it's a, you know, a petrochemical company, for instance, or toxic waste companies do intentionally, because they often are forced to operate in the U.S., they do intentionally seek out communities with the smallest amount of power to choose where they're going to site the toxic waste dump at the petrochemical plant. You know, so what does that mean? That really means they're choosing communities of color, usually rural communities of color, although sometimes inner cities as well. And so, you know, companies are very, you know, are consciously seeking out people who aren't going to resist their, you know, their toxicity. They're not going to resist their working conditions. They're not going to resist the wages that they're going to offer. And so that is definitely part of the decision making. Absolutely. And so it's, I would say that, you know, cheap labor is obviously enormously important, but it's cheap labor along with, you know, making sure that pushback against what they're doing is less likely to take place.
Let's talk about the history that you talk about of pollution, of toxic dumping. You know, many times in my arguments with libertarians, as they say that, you know, we don't really need an EPA, we don't need these environmental regulations. You know, we can just abide by some type of form of property rights where you can't inhibit my enjoyment of my property. So if your smoke comes on my property or your chemicals come into, I guess, presumably, I don't know, my waterfront. And the burning of the Cuyahoga River comes up often in these conversations. Tell us of how it was that the Cuyahoga River caught on fire, and when, and also tell us how that plays into sort of the birth of, I guess, the full on environmental movement as we know it today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this issue of being out of sight of moving production abroad. I mean, there's a labor side of it, and there's an environmental side of it. Because, you know, what was happening is by the 1960s, a lot of Americans really thinking that they're going to have a bigger piece of the pie going forward, and that, you know, the kind of gains that they've made to their union contracts over the last 20 years was we're going to continue. And as part of that, they really began, everyday Americans began to demand that the environmental impact of American industrialization really be limited, that we really start having serious pollution controls and start cleaning things up. So you have these moments where, just like at the Triangle Fire, where you had wealthy people like future Labor Secretary Frances Perkins witness people die, with the news media, particularly television, you begin to see where you have massive pollution incidents on the, you know, you begin to see these, if they're in the U.S., you see them on the front page of the newspaper, you see them on the television. And so in 1969, there's two events. One is a huge oil spill in Santa Barbara, California, where, of course, a lot of people would travel and go to beaches, and people had seen the beaches on television, so it had like a really outside part of American culture. But then also, as you mentioned, also in 1969, there's the river catches on fire, the Cuyahoga River catches on fire in Cleveland. That river had been polluted for a long, long time. It's lined with chemical plants, paint facilities, steel mills. I mean, it was, you know, it was basically a dumping ground. And what's really interesting about that, and what shows what's really beginning to change by 1969, is the famous picture of the fire. And if you Google Cleveland or Cuyahoga River fire, put it in Google Images, this is all you'll see. It's a picture that's actually from 1952. The fire itself was put out in 1969 before anybody could get there to take a picture. But a Time magazine reporter picked up on this story and ran the 1952 picture, and it takes off as a national story of how we need to clean up our industrial pollution. And so what the Santa Barbara oil spill plus the Cuyahoga River fire do is produce a national narrative that becomes popular not only with, you know, what we think of today as environmentalists, but with labor union members and everyday Americans, that we need to clean up the environment. Well, once again, the response of corporations to this is to begin to move this production overseas so they can once again belch smoke into the air and dump pollution into the water. And so, you know, just like, you know, in the Rana Plaza collapse, the river that runs through that town, and I kind of referenced this before, runs different colors based upon based upon what the factory's using that day. And it was a great New York Times story about how the kids going to school along this river, they have headaches, they can't learn, there's all sorts of health problems. Well, once again, it's the same industries and sometimes the very same corporations that were polluting America and treating workers terribly decades ago are doing the exact same thing today in Bangladesh. And so it's, you know, again, all that's really changed in many ways is the moving of all that production where Americans aren't going to complain about it.
And you know, talk about why it was so necessary, though, for a governmental response at that time. Like, why did we need regulations saying you cannot dump into the river? I mean, it seems remedial now, this idea. It seems, but why did we need those regulations? Why couldn't the market? I mean, is the there's no market solution for that. And what it really is in many respects is not just their desire to spew this stuff into our environment, but to do so, it's basically just cost cutting, say, for them, right? I mean, it's just we don't want to pay to deal with the full cost of our production.
Yes, no, exactly. I mean, and I think that, you know, I mean, they were dumping because they could. And there is no, I think that, you know, as part of the sort of, you know, what I really see is this idea of the market today is effectively a fundamentalist religion, that there's no way that, you know, there's no reasoning with these people to get them to question their beliefs. It's like any other fundamentalist faith, you know, it can only be failed. Like, you know, it doesn't fail. It can only be failed. And right. And I think that any real analysis of American history shows that there are no market-based solutions to social problems. The only solutions that have ever been crafted in this country are Americans organizing and then demanding that the federal government or the state government intervene in these issues, whether it's talking about labor standards, you know, we're talking about the minimum wage, we're talking about, you know, working hours and working conditions, or we're talking about environmental issues. And you know, throughout the 1960s and 70s, and it's worth noting that these laws, these fundamental laws, like, you know, the National Environmental Protection Act or NEPA that came right out of the Cleveland fire, like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, these sorts of acts, they are being passed almost unanimously in Congress. I mean, you know, they're doing, you know, the House votes on some of these bills are like 393-6. Nobody is opposing this. It is a bipartisan, unanimous thing that only a belief in the 1960s and 70s that only the government can do what's necessary in order to regulate the horrible environments of America at that time. And, you know, what's sad is how much of a pushback there's been and how organized corporations have been in trying to undermine that bipartisan belief that only the government can effectively regulate things like pollution, emissions, you know, these other key components of how we cleaned up our environment. And I think, you know, to go back to this issue that you had about memory, right, and the decline of the Great Depression generation as they're passed on, similarly, most Americans, they don't remember what the bad old days were like. Most of us at this point grew up with clean air and pretty clean water. We don't remember, you know, smoke, you know, the smoke of Beijing was the smoke of Pittsburgh 60 years ago. I mean, you know, the horrible rivers of China were the horrible rivers of Cleveland 50 years ago. That's becoming forgotten, and so we don't know just how effective the government's been. But all you have to do is go outside and breathe in the air and drink the water in your coming out of your faucet to really understand just how effective government has been in cleaning up our environment and how it needs to continue to do so.
And I will add that just as there's a parallel, I mean, you mentioned the spill off the coast of California. There was another spill a month or two ago, I guess it was, where we have oil washing up. And you also mention in your book The 1962 book, Silent Spring, which addressed the concern of DDT. And there was a study that came out, it was reported on today that, that DDT had actually even worse effects than we knew at the time in 1972 when we banned it, that it actually very well may contribute to breast cancer in the children of women who were exposed to DDT when they were when these children were in utero. And that DDT is a perfect example, right? Because we've banned it here, but it's still being used around the globe.
Yeah, and I think that, the environmental hazards, and sometimes American corporations are still involved with that. I mean, for instance, American companies still produce asbestos. They just ship it overseas. And so I think that, there's still a lot of nastiness, nasty chemicals out there that need additional regulation. And I think that, that study, which I also saw, if you still had DDT in use in the United States, I think I think that clearly suggests that breast cancer rates would be much higher. And I think that goes to show just how effective, again, government is in regulating our environment. I mean, almost everything the government's done to create environmental regulations has been tremendously successful in giving everyday Americans a better life. And I think that the lesson should be we need additional environmental protections from nasty chemicals and from other forms of pollution. And I think these market-based arguments that want to effectively recreate the America of 1911, would basically bring back a world where you do have high rates of cancers because of chemical exposure, where you do have working conditions that are terrible, where you do have pollution running through the rivers. And I think that it's very, very dangerous, these sorts of market-based arguments. But I will say as well that the fact that union jobs have been shipped overseas and that working-class voices have disappeared from the American political landscape or are increasingly disappearing as unions are crushed really gives the wealthy, the Koch brothers and others who are pushing these sorts of ideas, really gives them an unlimited number of ways to push that propaganda on us, because the only organized working class voice within American history, labor unions, the only group really able to effectively push back against this ideology, they are losing in the war against these corporations. And so it's very, very dangerous going forward, and I'm very concerned.
All right. So lastly, let's talk about Americans can do in the context of raising labor standards in other countries. And I also want to talk about this in the context of the TPP. My understanding is that there was actually some movement in Malaysia, supposedly in response to one of the issues in the TPP regarding the use of slave labor. I don't know if there was a relationship between that, but give me your take on the TPP, and also whether or not it provides any mechanism A to enhance the working standards in these other countries, or if it puts essentially a ceiling on the working standards in these other countries.
Yeah. Okay. So first, I think that the first thing we can do, if we want to improve the labor conditions and environmental conditions around the world and maintain those in the United States, I think the first thing we need to do is to fight the TPP. I mean, the TPP is tremendously damaging in so many ways, and for everything from not only shipping even more jobs overseas, but also extended drug patents, intellectual property rights, all sorts of things that are really, really problematic. But
And I should say, I should excuse me for interrupting, but I should say, I believe literally minutes ago, the House just voted to pass fast track authority. That is without the TAA, the Trade Adjustment Assistance. It will now theoretically go back to the Senate to be voted as a standalone provision, the Trade Promotion Authority, and then we'll see if the Senate passes this without that Trade Adjustment Assistance. But go ahead, Eric. I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I let's hope it doesn't. But I think that what's really scary about the PDP is the so-called investor state dispute settlement, which effectively allows corporations to within this agreement to sue other members of the agreement if they pass regulations that potentially undermine future corporate profits. So they can take them to these courts where there's no accountability. No conflict of interest issues for the lawyers that are prosecuting them. And they can say, okay, New York State, you just passed these laws that undermine or that limit, slave labor or limit Malaysian fish because of this slave labor that happens in that country. Well, Malaysia could potentially sue New York over this. And that's not an idle threat. You have earlier versions of this that have already been developing. Philip Morris is suing nations that are cracking down on tobacco issues. You have a French company that has sued Egypt because they raised their minimum wage. And potentially, these courts could effectively say that your law is costing this company X amount of profit, and then that country or that state is liable to have to pay that, which is very, very damaging. And there's President Obama keeps saying, oh, there's labor standards, there's environmental standards. But first of all, this whole thing's been negotiated in secret. Secondly, there's no real reason to believe that that whatever standards may be in there have any meaning. If the standards actually gave power to workers so that workers or citizens themselves could say, hey, right, these employers are polluting, et cetera, and we want to, we wanted to prosecute these companies and to make sure that they're not polluting our communities. There is some potential there, but the way it's set up now, no, it's going to be disastrous, and it's just going to empower corporations at the expense of not only us in this country, but the workers and citizens of the world.
Indeed, Eric Loomis, author of Out of Sight, the long disturbing story of corporations outsourcing catastrophe. We'll put a link to it at our page at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half in a moment. I mean, there's not a lot to say beyond that. This is, when we talk about these nine dead in this church in Charleston, we have to remind you that this is a black church, and I'm already seeing the right try and deny this is about racism. And it's just stunning. It really is stunning. It's disgusting. It's just demented. I don't even know what else to say about it. We're going to take a quick break, head into the better half of the program. Just a reminder again, today is the last day for the Credo Mobile deal that we have with this program. They are sponsoring us. If you go to credomobile.com/majority report, you'll see they've got a great deal for Majority Report listeners. You can also call them at 800-966-1665 and mention the offer code 501-882. They got a great deal for you. It's hard for me to be enthusiastic about this, but it is the last day that it's going on. But it is a depressing day to see this, and then just to see this reaction on the right. I'm sorry, but check it out. Credo Mobile, they support Credo Action, which fights for progressive values. They donate to progressive groups like Democracy Now!, like 350.org, Project Vote, Planned Parenthood. No cost to you, which comes out of their revenue. That's what the company is for. So check it out. They'll give you up to $350 per line credit to get out to pay for an early termination fee. And again, they're supporting this program by sponsoring us this month. It's credomobile.com/majority report. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. I will also take your IMs. We'll be right back after this.